Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the origin of public schools right after this. You know, marriage is a state-licensed business. It's a three-party, limited general partnership between you, your spouse, and the state. And like any other state-licensed enterprise, it is regulated by the Welfare Department, the Department of Family Services, and the Family Court. And the best part about all of this is that you have absolutely no input into or say-so over the marriage, divorce, dissolution, custody, alimony, child support, protective custody, or restraining orders. But you get to pay for all of that. And if you fail to pay, you go to jail. Now, marriage is the most important and also the most expensive contract that you can engage in. It's more binding and it's more costly than your military enlistment or your 30-year home mortgage. And you probably know a whole lot less about that marriage contract than you do about your military obligation or your house payments. 67%, 2 out of 3, of all marriages end in divorce. But whether you're a husband or wife, you do have rights, privileges, and immunities to advance, to protect, or defend against any breach of this marriage contract. And that's why you should know and understand the terms and conditions of that marriage contract before you marry. And you should be writing that contract instead of letting the state write it for you. Now, whether you're married or not, why don't you write for my free general law CD set and let me share some vital information with you about the law and this marriage contract. To order that CD package, just call direct 417-273-4967. It's a 4-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. If you're online, you can go to the website, georgegordon.org. That's easy to remember, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and then send an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. Well, back in 1886, Zach Montgomery wrote a book, a treatise, called Poison Drops in the Federal Senate. It's a treatise on public education, a comparison between public education and private education back in the 19th century. Back in the period of time from 1850 to about 1900, Zach Montgomery, who was appointed the Assistant U.S. Attorney, that is under President, I believe in 1886 would have been President Grover Cleveland. He took the job and was not confirmed by the Senate because of his stand on public education. His stand on public education was that public school was really a liability rather than an asset, and that every place that public school had been tested or tried, it bore poison fruit. Well, naturally, that wasn't politically correct back in 1886, since public school was getting off and started, and it was being copied from the German and the European models. And they decided that we don't need an attorney general or an assistant attorney general that's opposed to public education, since that's the modus operandi that we Americans wanted to follow. At least that's what the U.S. government wanted to follow. So he wrote a small treatise and he said, let me tell you what the problem is here. Let me give you a warning about public schools and what the fruits of public schools are. Now keep in mind that we're not talking about Johnny Can't Read. We're not concerned with sex and morality or immorality in the public schools as we are today. We're not talking about crime in public schools. We're talking about the origin of public schools. Now, remember, our Constitution does not provide for a public education system. Americans back in colonial times educated their own children either at home or in parochial or private schools. Public school was well known. I mean, public schools aren't something new. They go back into ancient times. But our founding fathers decided that the federal government had no business in the education business. In fact, the states themselves in the early days believed that they had no business in the education business at all. So how did public education get its roots and its tentacles into the American people? When did that occur? Well, the writer intends to offer no apology to the reading community for this publication. As soon would we think of apologizing to the slumbering inhabitants of a city in flames for attempting to disturb their rest by the vigorous ringing of a fire bell. Far better that they awake even in anger than to awake not at all. Now, if the reader will but follow us, even to the extent of a few pages, we promise to demonstrate by incontestable facts and figures drawn from sources that will not and cannot be impeached, that the calamity at which we are endeavoring to alarm our countrymen is far more widespread and direful in its consequences than any conflagration that has ever devastated a city in this country. We promise to prove that our boasted New England public school system, as now by law established throughout the length and breadth of the American Republic, is a poisonous fountain fraught with the seeds of human misery and moral death. But, says the reader, how can that possibly be true? Can it be denied that an educated people are more moral and virtuous, more contented, happy, and law-abiding than an ignorant people? And if so, how can it be charged that a system of education which almost entirely banishes literacy or illiteracy from the land is fraught with so much evil to those who are brought under its influence? Now, these are candid questions, and they shall receive candid answers. It's very true that ignorance is the mother of vice, and it's also true that an educated people, if properly educated, are more moral, virtuous, contented, happy, and law-abiding than an ignorant people. Well, thus far, we think there can be no difference of opinion between the most inveterate supporter of the New England public school system and ourselves. Now, keeping steadily in view this common standpoint, namely that a people properly educated are more moral, virtuous, contented, happy, and law-abiding than an ignorant people, let us suppose that we somewhere find living side by side two communities. One of these communities is made up almost entirely of educated people, while the other community is largely composed of illiterate people. And let us further suppose that amongst those considered educated, you find that in proportion to their population, they have six criminals, to where the more illiterate community have but one criminal. Suppose that they have nearly two paupers, to where the more illiterate people have but one pauper. Suppose that they have two insane people, to where the illiterates have only one. Suppose that their death list shows four suicides, to where that of the illiterates shows but one. And suppose that the same list shows three deaths from the criminal indulgence of the brutal passions, while that of the illiterates shows but two. What conclusion, then, would you arrive at with reference to that kind of education? Adhering to the proposition with which we set out a moment ago, namely that a people properly educated are more moral, virtuous, contented, happy, and law-abiding than an uneducated people, would you not be forced to the conclusion that there must be something wrong, something terribly, radically wrong in a system of education so much more direful in its results than even illiteracy itself? But just here, perhaps, the reader will ask us, as he has a right to ask, what application has your supposed case to the question under discussion? Just have a little patience, my friend, and you shall see the application. Now, for this educated community, let us take the native-born white population of 6 New England states: Massachusetts, Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, Connecticut, and Rhode Island. And for the unlettered community, the ignorant, the illiterate, the uneducated, we'll take the native-born whites of the 6 states of Virginia, Maryland, Delaware, Georgia, North Carolina, and South Carolina. And it will be observed that the states thus enumerated are either a part of the original 13 or such as have been carved out therefrom. Both of these communities started on their career of existence at about the same time. Both were composed mainly of people from the same part of Europe, people who spoke the same language and had been accustomed to the same laws, manners, and usages, people who possessed the same Christian religion, pretty much all of whom outside of Little Maryland were of the Protestant faith, and took as their religious guide the same Bible and even the same translation of that Bible. There was one important particular, however, in which these two communities widely differed at the very start, as we shall presently see. More than 200 years ago, the principle was incorporated into the legislation of Massachusetts that the whole people must be educated to a certain degree at the public expense, irrespective of any social distinctions. Again, in Massachusetts, by statute in 1647, each town consisting of 50 householders was directed to maintain a school to teach their children to read and write, and every town of 100 families was to maintain a grammar school to fit youth for the college. The common schools of Massachusetts have been kept up to this day by direct tax and individual subscription, and nowhere in a population of equal extent has common elementary education been more universally diffused. The compulsory system of supporting common and grammar schools in each town is sustained to this day in Massachusetts and enforced by indictment. At a very early day after their settlement, a similar system of education was adopted in all of the other New England states, from which fact the system seems to have taken the name of the New England System. And Chancellor Kent says, "In New England, it has been a steady and governing principle from the very foundation of the colonies that it was the right and duty of the government to provide by means of fair and just taxation for the instruction of all the youth in the elements of learning, public education." Now, on the other hand, the 6 enumerated states comprising what we have agreed to call the unlettered community steadily resisted the New England system up to a very recent date. Virginia, which occupies about the same relation to the latter community that Massachusetts does to the former, according to Lippincott's Gazetteer of the World, published in 1856, had at that time no general free school system, but made an appropriation for the instruction of the poor. Thus, these two communities, the one with its New England public school system, and the other without it, traveled along side by side for about 200 years until 1860, when the 8th United States Decennial Census was taken, and the following was the showing of these two communities, as will appear by reference to the annex table number 1. Now, we find that at the date referred to, 1860, Massachusetts and her five New England sisters had about 2.5 million native-born white inhabitants, and out of these, only 8,500 adults who could not read nor write. While Virginia, with her five sister states, numbered approximately 3 million native-born whites, of whom 250,000 adults could neither read nor write. So that in the six New England states, the proportion of illiterate native whites was only 1 to every 312, while Virginia and her five sisters counted 1 illiterate to every 12 inhabitants. But mark you now, how stand the criminal lists? Well, Massachusetts and her five sisters, out of her native white population of little more than 2.5 million, had on the 1st of June 1860 just 2,500 criminals in prison, while Virginia and her five comparatively unlettered companions with a native white population of over 3 million had less than 500 in prison. Five times as many people in prison in the New England states than there were in the South, with 500,000 fewer people. Now, that is to say that those educated under the New England system had one native-born white criminal to every 1,000 native white inhabitants, while those who had generally rejected that system had but one prisoner to every 6,500, being a disproportion according to the whole number of native whites of more than 6 to 1. That is, six criminals to every one criminal in the South. Now, at a glance at the same table, you'll see that the natives educated under the New England system had one pauper, one poor person, one person on welfare, as we'd say today, to every 178, while those who had managed to live without that luxury had but one pauper to every 345. That's a 2-to-1 ratio. Now, of those who in 1 year had died by suicide, New England had 1 to every 13,000 of the entire population, while Virginia and her five sisters had but one suicide to every 56,000. And of those who perished, the victims of their criminal lusts, New England had 1 to every 84,000, while her neighbors that had never enjoyed her educational advantages had but one such victim to every 128,000. Now, we have not before here, us, or we have not before us here a list of the insane in the several states for 1860. So we borrow from the report furnished by the census marshal of 1870, where it appears that the New England system produced of those born and living in their native states one insane person to every 800 native-born inhabitants, while the rejection of that system resulted in one insane to every 1,600 native inhabitants, or approximately 2-to-1. So here we have, if we pay attention here, approximately 2, 3, and 4 to 1 in these four categories. That is, people on welfare, people who are insane, people committing suicide, and people that are in prison institutions or have become criminals. Now, remember, they tell us that if you don't go to public school, if you don't go to school, if you're not educated, you're going to become either a criminal, poor and on welfare, insane, or you're going to have some other social debility or some debilitating social handicap occur to you because you're not educated. Now, from the statistics that we've seen, before the public school system was incorporated over all the states of the United States, and that in the prison population, the number is 6-to-1. There's six times more criminals being produced in the New England system than in the Southern free education system or the non-public education system. When we looked at the educated under the New England system, we look at paupers, and the number is 2-to-1. there's twice as many people on welfare in New England as there are in Virginia. And of those who had died by suicide, we find that there are four times as many people killing themselves in the New England states as in the southern states. And the same is true here of insane. There's twice as many people in the insane asylums in New England than there is in the southern states. Now, why is that? Would we say, then, that the public education system produces criminals, insane people, paupers, and criminals? Or would we say, well, they certainly don't, they don't prohibit it. They don't protect us from it. Now, I wouldn't go so far as to say that crime is created by public schools. I'll leave that for you to decide when we get to the end of the program here. But from the very beginning, I've got to tell you a little story here that occurred more recent times, 1968-970, along in there, in a case called Yoder versus Wisconsin. Yoder versus Wisconsin. An Amish guy by the name of Jonas Yoder pulls his children out of school. He lives up in Wisconsin, and he pulls his kids out of school, like all Amish people do, at the end of the eighth grade. Now, the Amish people educate their children in their own schools. They have Amish teachers, and the Amish teachers, of course, teach Amish customs and Amish beliefs and Amish religion and so on in the Amish public schools. But when these schools reach the eighth grade, the Amish people stop sending their children to formal education. And instead, they take their children out of school and they put them to work on the farm. Now, these children have been born on the farm. They've been raised on the farm. They've lived on the farm. But now, at age 14, they're going to work, just like adults do. They're going to get up in the morning at 4 o'clock and go to bed at night around 8. And they get up at daylight and they work until dark and they work on the farm. And the state of Wisconsin came to the conclusion that that wasn't good for children. That children needed to be educated until they were 16. That's what the law provided for. And then it provided that for Catholics, Protestants, and Jews. And there wasn't any good reason why Amish children shouldn't go to public school until they were 16. I mean, after all, the state agency's reason. If Amish children are not educated to age 16, they will not be socially adapted to the community. In other words, these Amish children are going to be socially retarded. For instance, they wouldn't know how to get laid in the back of your Chevy van. They wouldn't know how to split a line of coke. They wouldn't know how to roll a reefer with one hand. And, you know, in modern education, we feel that social acceptance is more important than the three R's. That's why we have this No Child Left Behind program. What we do is we want to make sure that every child, no matter how handicapped, is graduated in the same class as the most intelligent, brightest students in the school. We don't want bright, intelligent students and dumb, retarded students. We got to have one glove fits all hands. So we hold the bright ones back, and we do our best to advance the dullards so that we can have everybody graduating all at the same time. This is the communist philosophy. It's been going on that way for about, 50, maybe 75 years in this country. So Yoder is prosecuted by the state of Wisconsin. Yoder. Prosecuted. They charged him with child neglect and said, hey, you're not educating your children properly. So, case went to trial. Yoder was found guilty and fined $5 by the judge. $5. He didn't pay the $5 fine. He and the Amish community argued this case clear to the U.S. Supreme Court and spent somewhere in the neighborhood of $250,000. That's about what it costs to argue a case to the U.S. Supreme Court today. I would imagine back in those days, probably $100,000 would have done it. So probably $100,000, about a quarter of a million in today's dollars. And the U.S. Supreme Court came up with a very, very interesting conclusion. I got to share this with you, because in these four areas, you'll see this in the footnotes. They took a look at crime. Now, remember, the state of Wisconsin said, if these Amish children aren't educated to age 16, we're going to have a lot of crime. And we're going to have a lot of welfare. These students are going to end up on welfare if they don't go to school until they're 16 and be socially adjusted to everybody else. Suicide, we'll probably have a lot of suicides and mental illness if we don't educate these children, Amish children, to age 16. So the issue came up, and the question that was raised by the Amish was, how many Amish people do you have locked up in the prisons of Wisconsin as of about 1970? And the answer was zero. They didn't have a single Amish man locked up in any of the prison system. No Amish men, no Amish women locked up in the prisons of Wisconsin as of 1970. Now, I don't know how many Amish people there are in Wisconsin, but I would imagine there's 100,000. There might be 300,000 or 400,000 or 500,000, but I would guess, you know, that there'd probably be 100,000 of those people up there. There's about 3 or 4 million of them nationwide, and they're concentrated here in the Midwest. You won't find any out in the West, to my knowledge. You won't find any up in New England, but you'll find them here in the Midwest. Find them in Pennsylvania. So the next question that came up, well, if there aren't any Amish people locked up in the prisons of Wisconsin, of the people that you do have locked up in the prisons of Wisconsin, how many of them attended public school? And the answer was all of them. All of them. Think about that. The argument for education in the public education system in Wisconsin is, if you don't educate these children to age 16, my God, they'll end up in prison. When they compared the Amish population in Wisconsin to the prison population, there wasn't a single Amish person locked up in the prisons, but everybody who was locked up in the prisons in Wisconsin had attended public school. Second issue that came up was welfare. I said, my God, you know, if you're not educated, if you don't go to public school until you're 16, at least 16, preferably through college at age 22, but my God, the minimum is age 16, you people are going to end up on welfare. So they took a look at the Amish people that didn't educate their children to age 16. They only sent them to the 8th grade and didn't send them to the 10th. They sent them to the 8th grade and they asked the question, how many Amish people in Wisconsin are on the public welfare rolls? And the answer was none. Not a single one. They couldn't find a single Amish person on welfare in Wisconsin in 1970. None. So then they asked the question, well, of all the people who are on welfare in the state of Wisconsin, how many of them went to public school? And the answer was all of them. Every single person that was on welfare in 1970 in Wisconsin had attended public school. The Amish hadn't. They didn't have a single one on welfare. Does this prove then that if you don't attend public school, you won't end up on welfare? Well, I suppose there's a few people on welfare in Wisconsin. I suppose there's a few people that attended public school that aren't. We're not claiming that the public school causes welfare or that public school causes crime. Our point is public school doesn't prevent it, doesn't prohibit it, doesn't eliminate it, as is evidenced by the Amish. Third category was, well, you're liable to end up crazy. You're liable to end up in a mental institution if you don't go to public school. And so the state officers, the state agencies said, well, we need to protect people from insanity. And so educated people are less likely to become insane. So they took a look at the Amish people and said, well, how many Amish people do we have locked up in the mental institutions of Wisconsin? The answer was zero. None. Not a one. Zero. How many people that are locked up in the mental institutions of Wisconsin have committed suicide, or excuse me, are mentally unbalanced, or went to public school, I should say? And the answer was, well, all of them. Every single person that had been in or was in the mental system, the mental hospital system of Wisconsin, 1970, all of them had attended public school. Couldn't find any Amish people in there. Not because there aren't any Amish people in Wisconsin. There's a bunch of them up there. Now, that's the point that Zach Montgomery made back in 1886 in his book called Poison Drops in the Federal Senate. When comparing the public school system of New England to the private parental school system of the southern states, that is Delaware, Maryland, Virginia, North and South Carolina, they couldn't find a comparison. They found that when they looked at the numbers over here, there were 2-to-1 or 4-to-1 or 6-to-1 less in these categories. Why is that? Well, hang on, we'll be back with more on Zach Montgomery's book, Poison Drops in the Federal Senate, or The Origin of Public Schools in America, when we come back. Let me remind you that you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that's open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives. It can be accessed through the webpage. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. And the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. And the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour, an editorial review, gives credit to the authors and publications used on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. The endorsements or recommendations that we give do not necessarily mean that the authors or the publications so endorsed or recommended will reciprocate. And that's because most of the authors and publications cited on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily endorsed by the Law Hour, an editorial review, or vice versa. And the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call the Law School Direct 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. All right, tonight we're reviewing Poison Drops in the Federal Senate, The Origin of Public Schools in America, first published in 1886 by Zach Montgomery. Montgomery was appointed as the Assistant Attorney General by President Grover Cleveland, I believe it was. And he, consequently, was not confirmed by the Senate because of his radical, at that time, of course, it was a radical view of public education. He said, you know, there's something wrong with this public education. We ought to take a second look at it. Now, he went on to say that one very noticeable fact in this connection, as shown by the foregoing tables, is that the state of Massachusetts, which claims the honor of being the founder of the New England system of education, while Massachusetts had by far the smallest proportion of illiterate native-born adults of any, even of the New England states, Massachusetts had at the same time much the largest proportion of native white criminals, having one criminal to every 650 native white inhabitants. Now, the nearest approach to Massachusetts was the showing made by the state of Connecticut, where there was one native white criminal to every 845 native white inhabitants. And now, good reader, if you will take the pains to turn to the sixth column of figures in Table 3, which shows the relative proportion of native-born white criminals in every state in the Union in 1860, you will see that Massachusetts stands solitary and alone in the grand and magnificent proportions of her criminal list. California, at the same time, came next to her chosen model, having one native-born white criminal to every 697 native whites, while, as above stated, Massachusetts had one in every 650. Now, California seems to have resolved, however, not to be surpassed in her crime list, even by her great exemplar. For when the next decennial census reports were turned out in 1870, California made a showing of one native white criminal to every 500 native white inhabitants, thus carrying off the palm which 10 years before had been awarded to the old state of Massachusetts. Now, in view of the foregoing facts and figures, is it any wonder that the Boston correspondent of the San Francisco Morning Call Bulletin tells us that a large number of public school men have come to the conclusion that the public school system of that city is a failure? Or is it surprising that another of our leading dailies, the Alta California, speaking editorially of the same system as it exists in this state, calls it our anaconda, and declares that if we are to judge this system by its apparent fruits, we will have to pronounce it not only a melancholy but a most disastrous failure, and that it will be idle to look for the cause of the general rowdyism, idleness, and viciousness of the rising generation of American youth anywhere but in the training which it has been receiving in these public schools. Even after the Civil War, which raged with such terrible fury over the southern and southwestern states during the years from 1861 to 65, whereby property to the value of thousands of millions of dollars was destroyed, a servile race was emancipated, and the very foundations of the whole social and political fabric upheaved and broken to atoms, even after all the bad government which bad white men and bad black men had succeeded in forcing upon the subjugated southern states, still, when the census reports for 1870 were published, they showed that neither their native white criminals nor paupers counted in the proportion even of so much as one to where those counted two who had been for 200 years subjected to the ravages of the New England public school system. You'll see that in table number 2. So let me pause here for a little editorial comment. Even after the rapacious Civil War had torn the South asunder, 10 years later in 1870, we find that the North had more paupers, more people on welfare, more suicides, more insane, and more criminals than the South in the same proportion, 6-1, 4-1, and 2-1. See, even the rapacious ravages of the Civil War didn't increase criminality, pauperism, insanity, or suicide in the South. And this precious system of education is the great boon for which in 1870 the American people were paying to the tune of $64 million a year, while at the same time they were grinding through this mill of moral death no less than 7.5 million children went to those schools. Now, in order to maintain this very same system, California alone expended during the last fiscal year no less than $2.75 million, as appears from the recently published biennial report of the State Superintendent of Public Instruction. Now, if you're wondering why we're talking in millions of dollars rather than billions, it's because these statistics come from the 1860s, 70s, and 80s. Now, indeed, so infatuated has our young state, California, become with this crime and pauper breeding system of public instruction that she has made it a penal offense for the parent or guardian of any child between the ages of 8 and 14 years to keep such child from the public school, even for the sake of sending it to a far better private school of his own choice and at his own expense, unless he first seeks and obtains the gracious permission of the school directors to do so. But lest the reader should be disposed to doubt the existence of so tyrannical a statute, here it is as enacted by the California legislature on the 28th day of March, 1874. So public education was codified in California in 1874, says Section 1. Here's the citation from the original compulsory education statute in California. Every parent, guardian, or other person in the state of California having control and charge of any child or children between the ages of 8 and 14 years shall be required to send any such child or children to a public school for a period of at least 2/3 of the time during which a public school shall be taught in each city and county or school district in each school year commencing on the first day of July in the year of our Lord 1874, at least 12 weeks of which shall be consecutive unless such child or children are excused from such attendance by the Board of Education of the city or city and county or of the trustees of the school district in which such parent, guardian, or other person resides, upon its being shown to their satisfaction that his or her bodily or mental condition has been such as to prevent attendance at school or application to study for the period required, or that the parents or guardians are extremely poor or sick, or that such child or children are taught in a private school or at home in such branches as are usually taught in the primary schools of this state or have already acquired a good knowledge of such branches, provided in case a public school shall not be taught for 3 months during the year within 1 mile of the nearest traveled road of any person within the school district, he shall not be liable to the provisions of this act. Thus it is that the votaries of this system have absolutely undertaken by the most tyrannical legislation to strip every parent of the guardianship of his child and to transfer their entire control to the irresponsible board of school trustees so that if these school directors choose to appoint a libertine or a harlot as a tutor of your daughters, and at the same time refuse their gracious permission for you to send them to a private school of your own choice, it is with fines or prison dungeons that the law proposes to reward you, should you, in obedience to the dictates of right reason and your own conscience, seek to shield them from the contaminating touch of a vile teacher. Is it any wonder that vice flourishes or that virtue perishes under the influence of such a system? If Zach Montgomery could only see the public education system today with sex education in public schools and alternative sex or alternative lifestyles from sodomites and lesbians teaching those public schools, or if they could only see what has transpired in the public school system so that Johnny can't read. Well, he can't read any longer. Even in these schools in the 1880s, you know, children could read. But let me point out something to you here. As recently as 1950, for years the standards for behavior and for right and wrong were derived largely from religious teachings. When those teachings were disallowed in 1962, they were replaced with value-free teachings allowing students to discover and to set their own standards. The results are very evident. A lack of discipline and school violence are now the more troublesome problems facing America's schools. 14 of the 15 Gallup polls on schools during the 1968 to 1983 period cited lack of discipline as the primary problem. Before the ban on religious teachings and education, the top public school offenses were listed as talking, chewing gum, making noise, running in the halls, getting out of turn in line, wearing improper clothing, and not putting paper in the waste baskets. 1968 to 1983. Biggest problems that we had: talking, chewing gum, making noise, running in the halls, getting out of turn in line, wearing improper clothes, not putting paper in the waste baskets. Now, polls now list the top public school offenses as, listen to this, 17 of them: rape, robbery, assault, burglary, arson, bombings, murder, suicide, absenteeism, vandalism, extortion, drug abuse, alcohol abuse, gang warfare, premarital pregnancy, abortions, and venereal disease, in that order. Statistics published by the Department of Education, Washington, D.C. How about that public school, huh? Hey, we just can't get enough of that public school. We need more, don't we? Now, going on here with the subject matter, remember we're reading now from Poison Drops in the Federal Center, Poison Drops in the Federal Senate by Zach Montgomery. Let's go on to Chapter 2 and see if we can learn a little more. Well, in their desperate efforts to find some plausible explanation for the astounding growth of crime in the public school states, in excess of that found in the parental school districts, which will vindicate their idolized system, the advocates of state-governed schools, public education, have sometimes claimed that the difference between the number of convictions for crime in the public school states and the number of convictions for crime found in the parental school states is owing to a variety of local causes, local issues, which are entirely unconnected with the independent of difference in educational systems. But a complete refutation of this assumption is found in the following statistics of public school education and crime, demonstrating that in the very same localities, every material increase in expenditures for public school purposes has, without a single exception, been followed by a corresponding increase of crime. Let me repeat that. A complete refutation of this assumption is found in the following statistics of public school education and crime, demonstrating that in the very same localities, every single material increase of expenditures, that is, the more money you spend on public schools for public school purposes, it has, without a single exception, been followed by a corresponding increase in crime. The more money you spend on public school, the more crime will be the result. And there's never been an exception to that rule. All right, let's see if that's true. Back in 1850, the state of Massachusetts had a native white population of about 800,000 people. At that date, her public school pupils numbered approximately 175,000, and her income for the support of these schools was approximately $1 million, being about $5.70 for each pupil. Now, with this comparatively limited expenditure for the maintenance of her anti-parental school, she had out of a native population of 800,000, about 650 native-born criminals, being only one to every 1,250 native inhabitants. So about one out of every 1,250 people, a total of 650 out of 800,000 were criminals. Now, this, comparatively speaking, was a very small number for a public school state, though a very large number when compared with the number of criminals in any of the parental or private school states. Then in 1880, just 30 years later, we find that Massachusetts and its income for public school purposes has swollen to $4.5 million. So it went from $1 million to $4.5 million for the benefit of 300,000 public school pupils. That was about $15 per student, three times as much money now being spent per student, counting every pupil that attended school at any time during the year. But Massachusetts expended on her schools during the same year more than her income, the sum of $4.7 million being $20 for the pupils in average daily attendance. What was the result? Well, out of a native-born white population of 1,300,000, there were 2,000 active native white convicts. Now, that's one to every 638 inhabitants in place of one out of every 1,267, as it was in 1850. And this leaves out of the count some 608 juvenile convicts confined in various reformatory institutions. If we included those, the native white convicts of Massachusetts in 1880 would amount to one out of every 500 native white inhabitants. So, we spent three times as much money on education and we doubled the criminal population. So while we spent three times as much money educating children in public schools in Massachusetts between 1850 and 1880, we doubled the number of criminals. All right, let's take a look at Connecticut. Turning now to Connecticut, the land of steady habits, we find an entirely similar condition of things. In 1850, Connecticut had in her schools 80,000 pupils, with an income for school purposes of about $430,000, or about $5.50 per head. At that time, her native population numbered 330,000, of whom 250 were convicts, being one to every 1,358 native inhabitants. 30 years later, in 1880, her income for public schools was $1.5 million, being $12 for every public school pupil that attended at any time during the year, or counting only 72,000 pupils in average daily attendance, it would be about $20 per head. Out of a native white population of 480,000, she had 432 adult criminals, being one to every 1,136, leaving out of the count 430 juvenile convicts, the most damaging portion of the whole record, which when added to the results makes 835 criminals, or one in every 576 native whites. Again, we doubled the spending on students from $5 to $12, and we went from 250 convicts to 576. So by doubling the expenditures over 30 years on the public schools, we doubled the number of criminals. Gosh, I wonder if we could double, if we would find more and more criminals in Massachusetts and Connecticut today. And the answer is yep. We find that the more money we spend on public education, the higher the rate of criminals, the higher of rate that we find in suicide, insanity, and welfare recipients. And it's been going on since 1850. And this guy is counting now. He's putting the records together from 1850 to 1880, and I'm just citing this in the olden days. And then later on, we'll take a look at Schools Today, America to Pray or Not to Pray by David Barton. Has the public education system gotten better from 1880 to 1980 or worse? Guess it depends on what you're looking for. If you want more criminals, it's gotten better and better. If you wanted fewer and fewer criminals and less welfare, it's gotten worse. Let's take a look at Vermont. Likewise, in 1850, Vermont had an income for school purposes of $250,000 for educating 100,000 pupils, being about $2.50 a head. At that time, she had a native population of 280,000. Only 64, or one in every 4,300, were criminals. Turning to the census report for 1880, we find that Vermont was spending $450,000 on 73,000 students, $6 per pupil, or only counting 50,000 pupils in average daily attendance, we have about $10 per pupil. And instead of one criminal to every 4,300, as in 1850, she had 196 adult native convicts, about 200 out of 300,000, being one of every 1,400, or about 1,481, be about 1,500 native whites. When to these are added 134 native white juvenile offenders, of whom she seems to have had none in 1850, we have an aggregate of 330, or one native white criminal, for every 879 native whites. So let me just run this by you here for a second. 1,500. Let's just divide that by 330. That's 4.5 times. 4.5 times more criminals. In other words, we doubled the expenditures in Vermont and turned out 450% more criminals. Hey, not bad, huh? And you know, it's exactly that exact same statistic, that same trend in all six of these New England states. That's the bottom line to this report. It's true in New Hampshire, Maine, Rhode Island, Vermont, Connecticut, and New Hampshire, or Massachusetts, rather. Now, the numbers change a little bit, but the general trend is exactly the same, that it continues on this upward trend, including New York and Ohio, the states that adopted this public school system. Now, I told you about Yoder versus Wisconsin. When we took a look at this in 1970, about 100 years after this book is written, we find that in the communities of people that follow the parental system, that is, parents educate their children. It's a wild new concept. Instead of the state educating your children, you educate your children to your standards. Mormons used to educate their children to their Mormon standards, Catholics to Catholic standards, Amish to Amish standards. These are called parental schools, where they have their own religion. They're not amoral or amoral. They are moral. They have a moral standard. They may not agree with the same religious ideology, but they have a moral standard. And we find that in every case where parental schools, parental direction, we have less crime, less suicide, less welfare, and less insanity. And where we have greater expenditures for public schools, we have greater crime, greater welfare, greater suicide, and greater insanity. And it isn't something that just came out in 1990 or 2000. It's been going on for the last 150 years. I'm out of time. We're going to have to leave it right there. We'll be back again tomorrow night with the origin of the public schools. Make sure that you tune in. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law School... teaches family law, courtroom strategy and procedure, tax law, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Well, I'm about out of time. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So, until then, thanks for listening and good night, friends.